You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Films, the official expanded universe podcast of StarWarsReport.com.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
Welcome.
You're listening. Okay.
You just take it. Not doing a regular numbered episode is screwing us up. You just do it.
All right. You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Film feedback episode for March 2012. I'm one of your hosts, the defender of the EU, and with me, the EU guru himself, Nathan P. Butler.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone. And he didn't even name himself there. Mark Herleman. How you doing? See, now, we've got this beginning all kinds of twisted around now. That's what happens.
I'm just a defender. I don't even have a name anymore. Let's go by titles.
His name is Defender with a capital D.
Defendor, like Woody Harrelson.
Except then, you know, a defender of the EU, they're going to be like, so apparently he really likes France? What?
Nice. Oh, you know, and to start this episode out, we were talking before in the chat about some recent up and coming awesome things in our lives. And for me, I've got a photo shoot with my daughter, Jaina, the Sword of the Jedi, where I'm going to have my Jedi robe all nice and tucked down with her laying in it with my lightsaber hilt on it. Looking forward to having that. Nathan, you had a little special announcement kind of thing as well.
Yeah, I don't know if they would have heard the episode where we actually announced these things officially yet, because this is kind of an oddball episode that could come out at any time. We're just recording it at the end of March. But yeah, whenever I propose to my girlfriend, we watch the Clone Wars every week, and it's just kind of one of our ritual things whenever it's on, and she loves Yoda. So I went out and bought like this little stuffed Yoda. I mean, he's like the size of, shorter than my hand if I have my hand all flattened out, you know, if it's sitting up against the palm, a little tiny plush Yoda. But his hands are like sewn together as if he's praying or something, as opposed to meditating. So I took the engagement ring and I stuck it like between his hands so that whenever I held it up for her and could make like a Yoda voice, it had the ring like sticking out of his hands, diamond first.
Awesome.
So, yeah. I'm not sure if this is a good thing or not that you and I are taking our regular everyday out of Star Wars lives and blending it so much with Star Wars that we can't get away from it even for those life moments. I'm not sure how well that's working or how that reflects on us. But
when you have to stop at McDonald's because they have Star Wars toys in the kids' meal.
Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, where you can't stand to go to movie theaters because of the crowds and just the way that people act inside movie theaters these days. But you do brace yourself and go just to see the same movie you've seen 100 times that you have on Blu-ray at home in a clearer picture just so you can use those uncomfortable 3D glasses. Welcome to being a Star Wars fan, I suppose.
Do you walk through the toy section at the store, even though you've been there 5 times today, just in case they may have restocked something new?
Do you constantly, as you're walking through the toy section, grumble at just how freaking expensive those Legos are because you want one? You really want one. That's me right there, to a T. Do you have to keep buying book towers and bookshelves because there's just no space for this stuff anymore?
I go to Toys R Us and I'm like, why don't they have these at Walmart? Grr, exclusives! I hate exclusives!
The sad thing is we could probably do a whole, like, you might be a redneck thing, but make it you might be a Star Wars fan. The problem is they'd all be true, you know? They wouldn't just be jokes. But, you know, speaking of his reactions here, we're sort of off the cuff because this is a special episode that really puts the showcase on you all out there because, you know, the show's been out for a while. People do a lot of discussing through the Facebook page, but if you send us an email or something like that, sometimes that's something that we don't get a chance to respond to very quickly, or at least not in a public way where other people could join the discussion. We figured, you know, let's take a few of the more in-depth things that we've gotten and some of our smaller ones and give you essentially a feedback episode here and just start a pattern that, you know, once a month or once every few months, as the feedback builds up, let's put it together in an episode and let you hear our thoughts on whatever it is that you've submitted that may not have really gotten that much attention on the Facebook page prior to that. So I know, Mark, you've got all the different emails all laid out and ready to go here. So our first one comes from whom?
It's from Rob. And Rob writes, let me get back. I'm dealing with a small screen, and Jaina's in here angry at me for taking her room. I just listened to your podcast, and I'm enjoying it very much. The Plagueis novel discussions have been great. I just wanted to ask if you knew what issue the Insider magazine started to put back its exclusive fiction. I let my subscription run out and did not renew because of what you guys were talking about with the same old stuff. However, I do not want to miss out on any short stories / new fiction, so I would like to get some back issues. Problem being that I don't know how far back to go. Any suggestions? Thanks, Rob. And you know, Rob, I should know this because that is the issue I need as well. The one with Darth Plagueis' story.
Malgus.
Yes.
Malgus. Darth Respirator. I guess now there's, 10 of those with respirators. Now, that is issue number 124 of Insider. The story is the third lesson. It's the tie-in to Deceived, so it is the Darth Malgus story. That was when they finally brought it back. If you are going to go back and pick those up, there was an issue in there, which is escaping me right now, that only had an exclusive excerpt from Revan. But pretty much all the other ones in recent memory have had exclusive new fiction in there. And don't forget, though, there is an exclusive fiction story that was recent called Vader Adrift. It's not in the regular issues. You'd have to go back and get that special edition. I think they're calling it the 2012 special or special edition 2012, even though it actually, I think, was released at the end of 2011. It's that one that's got that really cool article on the comic strips that we talked about before when we were, I guess, at some point somehow, I think it was on maybe our year in review, we got off on this huge tangent about whether or not Insider was worth it, which I guess is what Rob's referring to here. But yeah, 124, easy to spot. It's the one with that famous cover that I joke about all the time where it looks like Ahsoka has been partying too much with Charlie Sheen because it's Ahsoka with Chewbacca, but she's covered in white powder.
With white powder, I love it. Our next one is from Jason, and Jason writes, "Hi guys. First time submitter. I'm a couple of weeks behind. Slow reader. I totally understand, Jason. I totally understand. So I just finished Darth Plagueis and your first three podcasts regarding the novel, but I wanted your opinion on a couple of things. You've already addressed them, great. If not, well, let's see. First one, does the novel make The Phantom Menace better? Or does the novel read like an apologist defense of The Phantom Menace?" I will go on a limb here and say, yes, it does make it better. Nathan?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When I see The Phantom Menace now, I mean, the Blu-rays, I gotta be honest, the Blu-rays to me made it much more watchable. I don't know why, but seeing the film on Blu-ray as opposed to on DVD has had me watch The Phantom Menace more often than I ever did before. But you're right, it makes it a better book or a better film because the book adds in those layers of depth. Like you expect to see Plagueis and the droid off on the side of a certain scene on a balcony, and you know that kind of stuff really does make it better. You see how it fits into the grand scheme of things better. You now have at least a little bit of backstory as to why it is that Anakin is essentially created through the Force as opposed to having a father. I mean, a lot of stuff is built up.
See when Maul's in the ship, you know where he got the ship. You're like, oh!
Exactly, and who designed it and everything. But I don't know. I think that the argument for that it could be like an apologist defense, I would say that Darth Plagueis is something that makes it work better. The apologists, to me, are in most respects, not always, because... Oh, no, I take it back. I guess maybe even always. I was going to leave Matthew Stover's Revenge of the Sith novel. That's my favorite Star Wars novel probably ever. I was going to leave that out, but you know what? I think it probably fits this too. I think the apologist angle is when you have a novelization of one of the films, and in that novelization, they're able to give more depth, and especially in the case of something like the Attack of the Clones novelization or Revenge of the Sith novelization, they add more scenes and more depth to the characters that you do not see on screen. So what may seem like
Karen Travis's Clone Wars, where we learn more about the 501st than the movie itself.
Right, exactly. Where, you know, there's like thin characterization in the films, but deep characterization in, you know, the novelization. I think that's where you got something more like an apologist thing, or at least it's ammunition for the apologists to say, well, there's more to it. I always call it the Stover effect, which I guess makes me kind of an apologist. You know, where I watch Revenge of the Sith and get a lot more out of it than I think a lot of others did on their first viewing because I had already heard the audiobook of the Revenge of the Sith novelization before I watched the film, and I really got a lot out of it. So, nice. Yeah, it made it better, and I don't think this is an apologist situation, at least not for this one, not this angle.
And Jason continues, I'm going to read the Phantom Menace novelization, hopefully next, or maybe Cloak of Deception before that. So it'll be interesting to see whether the two combine well. I think that it does make the Phantom Menace better, although sometimes the references to the movie felt a little forced. At one point, Plagueis even says something like, we'll be a Phantom Menace. Does the novel make the entire prequel trilogy better? Now, you know, when Plagueis mentioned the will be a Phantom Menace, I really liked that. I thought that that was a nice play into the movie itself.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's one of those things where it would have made more sense, I guess, if we had seen that before. Like, for instance, when I wrote Greater Good, which is either out now or about to be out as a professionally published novel through GrailQuest Books in the near future, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all that stuff. When I was writing Greater Good, you know, the name came from the concept behind the story, but it's also a phrase you hear the characters saying when they're debating some of the bigger issues of the plot points. That makes sense. Or, for instance, when I'm dealing with the second book of the Wars novellas that I wrote for also for GrailQuest Books, the first one's called Healers and Hunters, and there's a point in the second book where one of the characters muses on the fact that, once again, they're essentially being torn between their mission as a healer or a hunter. And I think that sort of thing, you know, it depends on how it's handled. If it's something that's an off-the-cuff thought, yes. But a lot of times I think it works out better if it's within the story itself and that it sort of justifies the title. Like, if the phrase Phantom Menace had been somewhere within the movie The Phantom Menace, I think it would have made the name make more sense at the time for a lot of viewers. I think now that's kind of an apologist thing, that's saying, well, see, the movie was named after what Darth Plagueis said. Yeah, you mean in that novel that didn't come out for years? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He may have said it chronologically earlier, but it didn't exist before. It's weird. I mean, it's a little forced, but, you know, it's kind of cool to at least be able to say that's where they can get that phrase from, because Phantom Menace, it really was kind of a weird title when we first heard it. I mean, everyone was like, yeah. Well, they were expecting In the Beginning or Genesis or something. Instead, we get The Phantom Menace, and nobody knew what the heck it was referring to.
Now he continues, does the novel make the entire prequel trilogy better? It certainly gives more weight to the thousand years of Sith hiding and the grand plan, and really ties the movie steadfast to all of the pre-movie EU. I'm going to go ahead and say that I would say no, it doesn't make the entire prequel trilogy better. I will say that, yes, it does add some depth to your knowledge of what's going on in the prequel trilogy, but the prequel trilogy itself is going to have to stand on its own. The EU can't do much to make the prequel trilogy any better. I mean, we got like Stover's book for Revenge of the Sith, which that will be, in my opinion, and probably Nathan's, a better version than the movie itself. But I don't think that Darth Plagueis by itself can make the entire trilogy better.
Yeah, I got to disagree. I think that having that depth, knowing better what's going on, makes the viewing experience in and of itself somewhat better. I mean, to know where it was that the money came from for Sifo Dyas ordering the clones, you know, and why was it that he did that. But I'll say this, it's, and I think this is something, I don't know if this is something that he also mentions in the email, so maybe I'm jumping the gun here. It only to a degree makes the prequel trilogy better, but I do think it does. One thing it does make a lot better for me, if you couple it with the recent releases of Restraint, Endgame, Wrath of Darth Maul, it makes Maul's return in the Clone Wars a lot better than it otherwise would have been. I like the Maul character now, when before I felt like he was sort of a stuffed shirt that really wasn't there to do much of anything other than to be the dumb muscle. And now we know he's not that.
So true. Yeah, I could see where you're going with that. For me, it was more like, well, it's not going to make the movie better. It'll make your understanding of the movie better. But the movie itself is going to be the movie itself. The EU is not going to be able to help it. But it'll help you understand it.
This is true.
Can the novel be considered an alternate first choice for those looking to get into EU novels and don't care necessarily about the big three? I think so, he says. And I will agree. I really think this is a great jumping in place for those that have been, you know, a little timid about the big novels and the vast collection of them that are out there. I think this is a great place to jump in.
See, again, I'm going to have to disagree. I think this is one that it's a great one to jump in the sense that it gives you a lot of depth on the EU from the standpoint of the prequels, but I don't think that reading it first is going to work for a brand new reader. I mean, someone who's relatively new, maybe they've checked out the essential chronology or something and maybe got a little bit of background of this era. I think someone like that it'd make a great jumping off point for, but we talked about this when we did the episodes about Plagueis a while back, that three-parter that we did. It might be very tough for someone who's new to get into this, because there are so many references. The Lucinopedia effect, the sheer amount of references and stuff that it crosses over with might be confusing. Like, okay, Maul's going off on this mission, now he's back, and they're talking about the aftermath, but we don't actually see the mission. What happened? Well, it's in this short story from years and years and years ago, this ebook that went along with the Shadowhunter book. Oh, Shadowhunter? Yeah, that's another book from years ago. I don't know. See, I think it might be tough.
Zahn's novels were like that, that Lucinopedia effect that you said. I remember when I was reading them, there were lots of whole, you know, concepts that are distinct to Star Wars at the time getting into. I had no clue what it meant. And so I would just kind of like have to skip the word and kind of figure it out later as I went. So I have to agree with you on that regard that, yeah, you could probably get lost in a lot of what's going on. But I really enjoyed the story. And I think, you know, yeah, there was a lot of references going on, but I don't think you had to actually get them to get the most out of the story.
Very true as well.
Plagueis notes how being so involved with the Republic and the heart of Coruscant would be the downfall of the Jedi, which I thought was a great thread to Luke's decision for the Jedi to leave Coruscant in Fate of the Jedi. Must be intentional, right? I want to say yes. I think that was a very direct reference to events that we see later in the EU, not just with Luke and Fate of the Jedi, but all the way through. I think that was a very good point, and it does play on to why the Jedi lose in Revenge of the Sith.
And plus, of course, you have the whole issue of how, you know, when Luke forms the Jedi Order, the new Jedi Order, he leaves Coruscant. You know, he goes and does it on Yavin 4, and then he comes back to Coruscant only to wind up moving off elsewhere again later on, which was kind of interesting. You know, there is that level of how much do you let those get meshed into government? You know, are the Jedi tools of the government? Are they an independent order that advises? You know, what exactly are they? It's, in a sense, the Star Wars equivalent of the whole church and state issue, you know, that we deal with in modern day politics. Although, I do have to say that from a broader standpoint, I'm not sure that they were necessarily referring straight to that so much as they were just getting into, you know, how the prequels were going to go very badly for them. I find myself intrigued by, in one of the more recent issues of Agent of the Empire, it's Agent of the Empire, I think it's number 4, it's the Iron Eclipse storyline, the penultimate issue, so I guess it has to be number 4. We find out that Jahan Cross and his family were caught on Coruscant when the Battle of Coruscant took place in Revenge of the Sith, and the way that impacts his family solidified his beliefs in the rightness of the Empire and in the wrongness of the Jedi Order, because essentially he's believing the propaganda that comes out about the Jedi trying to overthrow the Chancellor and all this kind of stuff. So it makes for some great angles to come from. Are they referring to one specific incident here? That I don't know. But it certainly is kind of a cool reference to the fact that we know these things are coming and the Sith see it coming, but the Jedi, for some reason, don't seem to.
Indeed. Being fairly new to the EU, I hadn't read any pre-movie material before. But I was amazed by this novel and am intrigued to dwell deeper. I didn't feel like I missed out on a lot, not having read the other Darth Maul stuff or the comics, though I'm sure they enriched the experience. And they did. I mean, it was one of those things where it had been a while for me for some of these, so it was like, okay, didn't that happen in a comic? And I'd grab it and I'd bust it out. Oh, sure enough. But it was one of those things where there was so much going on that not every reference I even caught. So I really enjoyed it. I don't think you absolutely had to have read these things to enjoy it.
So maybe it's less like, you know, you need to understand where the mission was, and it's more like, the bounty hunter we ran into on Ord Mantell changed my mind. You don't need to know which of the 6, 7, 8, 35 different versions of that story actually took place in order to understand the reference and like The Empire Strikes Back.
Indeed. And he finishes his email with, love the new show and love the old shows as well. And thanks from Jason. And Jason, we thank you for your feedback. And we also have, and I don't have his name, it's at the bottom, but this one I believe is from Andrew Halliday. We've got, hello, Nathan and Mark. I've just finished listening to your podcast about personal canon. I loved what you guys had to say on the topic, but if you don't mind, I'd like to expand upon 2 points. First point...
Nope, stop. I mind. No, I'm kidding.
My first point is admittedly something that is confusing to a lot of people, and I may have this wrong. In your discussions on canon levels, you mentioned that material that is C-canon that gets overwritten or contradicted by other C canon or higher material can get downgraded to S level canon. I understood that this is not the case. The way S-Canon was explained to me was that it was temporarily middle ground until final decisions could be made what stories that were canon and which ones weren't. I think what you might be meaning is we may have had a Freudian slip. I think we would have only mentioned G-level canon bumping a C-level down to S-level, so maybe we might have accidentally slipped a C in there. He continues, old material, such as Marvel Comics, news strips, comics, etc., were placed in the S-canon category only until it could be decided if they could be upgraded to C-canon, with retcons as needed, or if they needed to be downgraded to N-canon. Material could not be downgraded to S-canon, because that would be tantamount to simply rendering them non-canon altogether. Maybe I'm wrong, but I seem to remember this was Leland's explanation.
I think that's the case. I mean, I remember that part of the episode kind of sitting back going, oh, interesting, because I hadn't heard that in recent memory. But we're in this weird situation now with the whole T-canon thing, that there are some things that are thrown into question that you can almost only assume is, if it's not S-canon, it is some form of equivalent of what S-canon meant. You know, that it's hanging out there in limbo waiting to see what happens. Like, you know, the different versions of Anakin's knighting, or the different time frames of Anakin's knighting. That sort of thing, or say the fate of Asajj Ventress, you know. Until we see what happens with the Clone Wars continuity as a whole, until we see where T-canon goes, you know, does the ending of the story for Ventress and Obsession hold any weight whatsoever? So, you know, I think the concept there is valid, that there is some kind of questionable place to put things while things are being worked out. Yeah, temporarily is the key word there, but I'm not sure that just seeing something like, for instance, us seeing Asajj Ventress go off on her merry little way in the Clone Wars cartoon series as T-canon automatically takes the C-canon version and drops it into N-canon, non-canon, non-continuity, so much as it puts it in flux, puts it in question. So yeah. I think in certain cases you can see it jump into something that's questionable, quasi, whatever. I mean, there's so many different ways of referring to it. Suffice to say, something in limbo.
Second, I wanted to expand upon something you touched on, the idea of personal retcons. While distinct from personal canon, I think the idea of personal retcons, tiny measures which help to fit the EU together, are essential for keeping sanity within the EU. If there is an apparent discontinuity between two items, but neither Leland Chee nor the authors nor Lucasfilm provide an official explanation, then a personal retcon might be in order. It's just a little piece of logic that might serve to fit everything together, but has no bearing in official continuity. This personal retcon might be quite significant. Example, there were two Jedi by the name of Evan Peel, fixing how he could be dead in Citadel Rescue, but alive in Jedi Twilight. Or they might be much smaller. I-5 sample of Boda went bad over a period of less than 2 years, helping to fix the dating problems in Patterns of Force. I have a lot of fun with retcons. See my article on EU Cantina about retcons. But I acknowledge that these explanations could be defined as an acceptable form of personal canon. Now, when we had our episode, Tashi Station had one on headcanon, which in a sense is the same as personal canon, but I would say headcanon is probably closer to what you're referring to in this case, where it's not an actual canon of sense, but more what you do to get through it. Personal retcons are exactly that. There's a lot of personal retcons that I have that, you know, I don't really consider them any kind of canon officiality, but like, oh, let's say Old Wounds, for example, or the Tales story where Maul and Vader fight and it's Maul's clone. I mean, to me, in my own retcons, those happen still. So I don't know. I agree with you. I think that can be expanded upon.
Yeah, I mean, personal retcons, I think, I wouldn't even think of them as retcons. I mean, I guess they are. You know, those little leaps of logic that we have to do to make sure that things sort of fit together. Like, for instance, at the end of Death Troopers, at some point Han must get the Falcon back. Or at the end of The Force Unleashed 2, at some point Vader must escape Rebel custody. And at some point, somehow, the Starkiller clone must disappear from the galactic scene, otherwise why isn't he in post-The Force Unleashed 2 kind of stories? But I guess I never really thought of those as big-time retcons so much as it's just those little logical things we have to just sort of assume are happening. I think those are things that almost, since it's so obvious, for instance, that Vader must escape or that Han must get the Falcon back, that they don't need a story to answer those questions. It's a weird thing, way of leaving something off, but you don't expect a purposeful reference or a whole story dedicated to answering it And that tends to be when they create the retcons, is when something else is created that addresses a topic that's similar or addresses that era, we might throw in a line or two here to make the retcons actually work. So I think that would work. I think that's a very acceptable way of doing it, as long as, again, as long as, for instance, maybe in your mind, Han gets the Millennium Falcon back after Death Troopers in a very specific way. He goes to Alderaan and does this. He goes to Ord Mantell and does this, and maybe bumps into yet another bounty hunter or something. He winds up going, getting help from Jabba the Hutt, yet another loan or something, and then, aha, now he has the Falcon back. If you do something like that, that's a little bit more direct, like, for instance, a thing about how, well, you know, maybe the Boda went bad in the span of a couple of years, that sort of thing. You know,
yeah, well,
you've got to
create fan fiction for the retcon. You might be going a little too far.
I mean, it's all sort of fan fiction, but don't bring it into a debate. It's the same thing we said about personal canon. Do not bring it into a debate. Don't try to say that, you know, well, we know how fast it is that Boda goes bad because of what happened with Patterns of Force and when it took place, when we know the whole reason it went bad was because he kept messing up the dates and he meant for it to be a much longer period of time. There's a level at which we need an actual answer, as opposed to saying either it went bad faster or there was another reason for Vader having essentially a bad acid trip because of the Boda. I mean, there are ways you could explain away either direction, but since we don't have an official answer, don't walk into a debate with one of those as the only explanation you're willing to assume. You can say, now assuming such and such, then that's fine, but make sure you keep your arguments intellectually honest.
True that. He continues, I love the work you guys are doing on Beyond the Films and look forward to future episodes. And don't worry, Andrew, we've got plenty of them lined up when we recorded this one, and probably three more come out before this one airs. So, you know, if you have any topics that you want to see us talk about, let us know. Fire them off. Send us some email. Get us on Facebook, Twitter. You know it. Nathan, you want to hit us with the contact information and we will bounce out?
Sure thing. You can catch us via email, beyondthefilms, that's beyond the films, make sure that the's in there, at StarWarsFanWorks.com. You can also catch us on Twitter at SWBeyondFilms, all as one phrase there, SW for Star Wars, no the, just Beyond Films after it. Same thing on Facebook now, Facebook.com/SWBeyondFilms. And you can get to any of our other pages, whether it's my page, Mark's page, my author page, the Timeline Golds page, all the different pages we are all connected to through that page, thanks to things like the little favorites box that they do. And of course, if you want to drop us a review, we would always appreciate that on the Zune Marketplace or on iTunes. So let us know what you think of the show personally, but if you put the word out there for others to see, that would be very helpful and very appreciated as well.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
For Star Wars Beyond the Films, in this relatively short little feedback episode, this has been Nathan P. Butler,
Mark Herleman, and Whistler.
May the Force be with you.
And don't quote us the odds.
See, at least we got the ending right. At least we didn't clash on the ending.
Hey, something was in our favor.